This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome friends, family, fans and fiends to my fourth edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you all for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris and this is my 16-week podcast series for LGBTI influencers, where each week we sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us and mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is known for his work in the pool. He is an Olympian, originally represented as, well, people said you were the first openly gay gold-winning Olympian. Is that right?
Male.
Male.
Yeah, because Okay. Lesbians have been, you know, doing all the hard lifting for a long time.
You also have an autobiography out called Twists and Turns, and I read this a couple of years ago and loved it.
Thank you.
Was it hard to write?
It took me a long time to write. It took me a year and a half.
You also would have seen him dance his way through to the finish line. Coming second on Dancing with the Stars is pretty impressive.
I mean, it's not as great as winning, but it's okay.
Our guest has also featured in countless publications, praising him for his attitude on being a fantastic athlete, but also a fabulous role model. Welcome today, Matthew Mitchum.
Making a splash, diver Matthew Mitchum has won all three individual disciplines.
Clocked the highest score in Olympic history.
I had depression from 14 to 18.
Well, we all know Matthew Mitchum as the gold medal winning Olympian.
Actually getting an Olympic medal was like the best moment of my entire life.
We met a couple of years ago at the Ryden Festival, which was in the Hunter Valley, where you got up and you were a contributor to a youth program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously I knew a lot about who you were, but it was coinciding with the time that your book came out. So I stayed up all night and read your book. And I think the one thing I've noticed about you is you have a raw honesty about you.
Mm. That's been a process, as I think it has with a lot of LGBT people who have had the experience of that whole, you know, closet experience, you know, the shame of and the negotiating that whole identity thing and you know, battling like how authentic to be in certain situations because of, you know, safety or shame or any of that sort of stuff. So I went through that whole process. You know, especially in the sporting environment, I started training with the Australian Institute of Sport squad from the age of like 12, which is obviously much too young to have established my sexuality. So, you know, by the time I did sort of realize what my sexuality was, I'd already been training with these people for like 5 hours a day, 6 days a week for a couple of years already. And so I kind of felt stuck because I didn't want to then come out to these people because I felt like I would be admitting that I'd been effectively deceiving these people, lying to these people for the preceding 4 years.
I think it's interesting that you say that because that's for a lot of people, their reason is that they struggle to come out because they feel as though it was a lie or they're being dishonest.
Mm.
But isn't it more that it was your own journey? I mean, it's not exactly like when you find out about your sexuality, you get a letter in the mail and it turns out that that's what you are. So I think, you know, you weren't necessarily deceiving them prior to telling them. It was more your own self-journey.
And I guess this is why these kinds of interviews are important for, you know, young or not necessarily young person who is grappling with that whole identity stuff, to listen to this and go, oh, okay, like other people have this experience. I'm not the only one. And it doesn't mean that I'm being disingenuous. It just means that I, you know, am negotiating this and it's all part of the process. In fact, that not being forthright with my sexuality actually, I believe, caused more problems because there were consequently trust issues because everybody that I was training with, they spent so much time with me that they could tell that I was withholding something about myself, that I wasn't being forthright with them. And so there were consequently trust issues. And so I was very ostracized within my training environment because I was not really fully present or not like honest and authentic with people. And so when I retired from sport at 18 and, you know, got super comfortable with myself and changed cities, I saw that as an opportunity for a fresh start. And so I started diving again in a completely different city.
You were more knowing of yourself.
Yeah. And well, I mean, when I moved to Sydney, I made the conscious decision that I was going to be 100% open and honest with everybody I met because of the difficulty and the harm that I had experienced not being authentic with people. And so that conscious decision led to several choices that I made throughout my life. It was probably the catalyst for how well my diving progressed in the 15 months leading up to Beijing, because I was happy, I was present, I was being, I was accepted, you know, it was accepted for exactly who I was. So that was very validating and affirming. And yeah, I was really, really happy. And then when the Sydney Morning Herald sent a journalist out to the pool to profile all of the athletes in the lead up to the Beijing Olympic Games, the journalist asked me all of the general questions, you know, how old I was, where I lived, who I live with. And so I just said, I live with my boyfriend. And she, like, her eyes lit up. She was like, I think she was super shocked. Because I guess
she had an exclusive.
Well, yes, exactly. I don't want to be like, you know, I don't want to be imply that this was salacious or that she was salivating or anything by getting this massive scoop. But it was a massive scoop because nobody had ever come out before their Olympic debut before.
Well, I think we'll get into that a little bit later because I think all of that is incredibly interesting and it's so a part of your story. And wow, that you were an athlete and so young, thrusting yourself into that environment. You know, look, I think that is so interesting because a lot of athletes out there do struggle with it. But I do want to go back because, like, you're originally from Bris Vegas.
Correct.
From Brisbane. And you grew up with your mum. Mm-hmm. That's like, so she was more like a single parent.
Yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit about Matthew as you were younger? Like, what were you like as a kid?
I did not make it hard for people to guess that I was a little gay boy.
For me, I remember being at school and a teacher came up to me because I was playing with girls and she said, I think you're sitting with the wrong people.
Yeah, I identified more with girls, I think. I think that's what it is because obviously, you know, sex and attraction doesn't come into it when you're that young. So it's more about identification and, like, you know, birds of a feather. Mm. Anyway, I preferred the girls' games. You know, I liked skipping and I also, you know, used to go to Spotlight with my grandma to choose the material for my leotards. So there's a whole lot of gay right there.
What colour will you be wearing today, Matthew?
Oh, not just one colour, every colour, like multicoloured checks all over the place. And pink and blue snake skin and purple crushed velvet and, oh, yeah, gay.
Were you introverted or were you extroverted, though?
That's a really hard one. I think I was introverted, but I projected extroversion for validation. I guess I felt like I wasn't getting the positive reinforcement that I felt like I needed. And I learned that when I did something outstanding, I would get that positive reinforcement and that validation. And so that's when I learned that, you know, by doing good things or big things, you know, I would get more of that. And so I guess I remember having this very, very definitive thought at around the age of 8 that, like, if I was the best in the world at something, then my mum would love me and everyone would love me. And I hadn't even started sport yet. I just wanted to be the best in the world at something.
And what happened to you environmentally to believe that sort of stuff is probably what took you to being an Olympian, though.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, I think you were building some foundation of survival, and I think that that sort of led you somewhere.
Yeah, so, I mean, I tried lots and lots of things as a child. I wasn't very good at sports, actually.
Group sports, or do you think, or solo sports, or at all?
I was not good at sports at all. Soccer, all the team sports, you know, like picking off for teams at lunchtime, always last to be picked. You know, like even the girl with asthma got picked before me, like bad, like really just lanky, uncoordinated, not good.
I just love the idea of you standing around at school being the last person picked, but you're a gold Olympian and
I found my niche. Artistic sports, perhaps unsurprisingly, is where I found my niche.
So your ability and your attributes and all of that was within you just hadn't really come out yet.
Yeah, well, I totally believe that adversity can be the birthplace of, you know, really amazing work.
Well, I think as you got older and you were starting to, you know, turn into an adult or a young adult, we have to really say, because you were a young adult being thrust into the media. Do you think your sexuality changed you from who you were originally as a kid? When I say that, it's because I feel like when we're younger, we can be loud and boisterous and we don't know our sexuality. And then as we get older and it becomes apparent that that's who we are, we do kind of change a little bit.
Mm.
Do you think once you became a young adult and you started to become more aware of your sexuality that you changed?
So I knew that I liked boys from a very young age, probably about 5, I reckon. I always knew. But what I probably didn't understand was the social implications of the mannerisms, like, that are often associated with, you know, like the, like, well, I guess the social constructs of masculinity and femininity.
You were spending an enormous amount of time with your mother.
Mm.
And so I think regardless
and of grandmother.
That, and grandmother. And grandmother. Well, strong female role models in your life.
Yeah.
You probably did idolise that in a way.
I didn't have that shaming influence, like, from around, you know, my behaviour or around my, perhaps what would be perceived as more effeminate qualities.
Maybe not having a brother or a father around, like a brother that would pull you in on it,
mm-hmm.
or a father to be concerned of it, maybe those impacts weren't there.
Also, I probably didn't really have hypermasculine behaviour modelled for me either. Mm. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's only just one part of, you know, a whole series of things that go together to make up one's gender performance and gender expression. And I mean, yeah, I wasn't discouraged from any behaviours, which is nice. The shame, I guess, like around effeminity was probably self-imposed the older I got. And actually probably around school time, you know, like when other kids probably started pointing out
your sexuality before you knew what it was.
Or, yes, yeah, picking parts of me that were different from the other boys and then honing in on those as a target because, you know, children can be evil.
Absolutely.
They have a sixth sense for weakness in others. And so, yeah, just any differences like that would be pointed out, and that's when I started realising the performative differences of my gender and sexuality.
Isn't it interesting that we don't really know our personality at that young age and that some of it does get changed in a way?
I guess, you know, our personality, who we are, a lot of it is dictated by our interactions with others. It's how we want to look to others. It's, you know, which behaviours and which things get reinforced and which ones get shamed, and therefore we, you know, we change to fit in or we make a conscious decision to not change. Mm. But these are all choices, whether we make them consciously or not. And we probably do make a lot of them consciously, but we just forget that we have made them consciously because we made them so long ago. But these are all choices that we make about how we present ourselves to the world.
But what makes us different and what makes us stand out is sometimes as a kid what we got picked on for, but they can become the things that we love, you know, that makes us stand out.
Yeah, I didn't realise that, you know, these things that the other kids were targeting, I didn't realise these were things that I should be ashamed about until, you know, other people started picking them out as differences. Mm. And I guess, you know, as a child, you're so insecure that you just want to be accepted.
And which sort of leads to pleasing. Did you...
People-pleasing, totally, yeah.
Do you feel like you're a people-pleaser in a way?
I did for a long time. And, like, I sort of still do now, but I'm much more aware of it and I can actually make much better, healthier choices that aren't where I don't sort of sacrifice myself. So I'm not martyring myself to please others, but I do, you know, I still like to be a good role model and I still like to help people. Like, I like being of service to others. I find that very rewarding, but not to the detriment of myself.
When did that shift though? Like it didn't completely, you're not saying that it completely changed. You still are a people pleaser in a way, but when was the most noticeable change?
Well, I guess when I went to rehab in 2011, I think, you know, when all of my character defects, I guess, and my self-medicating behaviour led me to realise I really needed to change something because there were lots of faulty thinking, like faulty thought patterns and behaviours that were not making me feel better. Even though I was, you know, reaching out to all of these external things to make myself feel better, they just weren't working. And so I realized that I needed to do something about it. And so I finally went to rehab and sort of learnt about what, like, how my head ticks and what's causing me so much pain to want to medicate, and, you know, what the underlying causes of my depression and self-esteem issues are, and all of that sort of stuff, and learned about boundaries. And I just learned a whole lot of things and actually really built up quite an armory of tools so that I don't ever get to the point where I feel like using drugs and alcohol to make myself feel better is ever a good idea.
Instant gratification, do you think that had a lot to do with it?
Totally.
So,
absolutely.
Like, you just learnt to be, to grab for, to reach for the most quickest response.
Quickest and most powerful. And, yeah, I don't think I ever learnt good coping mechanisms as a child to deal with my feelings, because those probably weren't really modelled well for me as a child either. Like, that's how we learn how to moderate our feelings and behaviours, is through our parents. And, you know, I grew up with a single parent who, you know, was dealing with her own mental health and physical issues, and, you know, is decidedly not very good at moderating her emotions.
Now that you're older and you think, well, I'm old enough to be a parent now, you then start to realise that being a parent doesn't all of a sudden make you
with the skills, yeah.
You know, so you think, When you look back at that now with your mother, the way that she was, I mean, she was just living her life.
She was doing her best with what she knew how to do, but she admits that she did not do very well with that sort of stuff, and she's since done a lot of work to improve that, you know, on her emotions and her anger management, and yeah.
What's your relationship like with your mother now?
It's much, much better. Because we've both done a whole lot of that work.
Together?
Yeah. No, not together, individually, but we have done a lot of stuff together as well. Like, we still go to AA meetings, like, once a week together, because she was a chronic alcoholic as well throughout my childhood. So that, you know, contributed a lot to the anger and emotional issues. But when I went into rehab, she got sober as well. So we've done our whole journey of sobriety together as well. So we've both been sober for 6 years.
So powerful to think that the two of you did do that together.
Yeah.
I think it is powerful. I mean, it shows that a lot of trust, I think, still between the two of you.
I think we were both in a lot of pain individually, and I needed to do that stuff to, yeah, just because it, like, my life wasn't working and I was in a lot of emotional pain, and I needed to, and I had responsibilities, you know, like, I was this Olympic athlete that needed to go to represent the country at another Olympics, and I was, you know, doing all of this behavior that was decidedly not very Olympian, and so I needed to fix that, but also I was in a lot of pain and I needed to change that as well. I mean, I guess she was inspired by what I was doing, and so she decided to do the same thing.
You came out in 2008, but when did you tell your mum that you were gay?
I told her when I was about 14. I couldn't really hide it any longer because she found some porn on my computer. So that was a kind of like a bit of a smoking gun where I had to go, actually, I think I'm bi. Once I realised that I was like not in that whole, like, I didn't fit into that heteronormative standard, I, you know, tried to open my mind to everything and I wanted to try everything before I bought. That expression only makes sense in the present. Try before you buy. I wanted to try everything before I bought. Doesn't rhyme. Anyway.
Well, I don't necessarily even know if you were being a trisexual. Was it more that you said that you were bisexual to your mother because...
As a gateway?
Yeah.
I didn't, because I was still experimenting.
So were you still sleeping with girls?
Or, yeah, until I was 18.
Right.
So this mum found porn on my computer when I was 14. So I told her that I was bi, but I'm pretty sure it was also like a hedging type, you know, a revelation in case, you know, it's like a step before gay. Well, I was already pretty sure that I preferred men, but I also didn't want to limit myself until I was entirely sure.
It's like dipping your toe in the water, maybe.
I wanted to be very open-minded about everything. I didn't want to close myself off to any experiences, which I now realise might have not been the best mentality, particularly when it came to... Because I applied this mentality to everything, and that included experimenting with drugs as well. I was like, I'm going to try everything because I'm so open-minded. This was a mistake.
No, not necessarily. I think what's beautiful about you as a person, and I got a sense of this when I read your book, was... I mean, you just were open and you were looking for who you were. Mm. And in some ways, you probably aggressively threw yourself at things, some of them possibly the wrong things.
Yeah.
But you still had a fearlessness about you and a determination and a thirst for life, you know.
Mm.
And I like that about you. Like, I prefer for you to make mistakes and be true to yourself than to censor yourself, you know?
Absolutely. And that's what my idea of a good role model is. It's not someone who never makes mistakes because, frankly, that's super unrealistic.
Yeah. You've mentioned a couple of times about an addiction that you had.
Mm.
Can you specify that addiction?
I say that addiction is addiction. I could potentially be addicted to anything, but it was crystal meth that really brought me to my knees and realised that I needed to do something to change my life.
Was that you doing that, or did someone get you into that?
No. I mean, this self-destructive behaviour, these not coping mechanisms, started at about the age of 13 or 14. I started falling into this pretty profound period of depression, actually, from about the age of 13 or 14. And that first started manifesting in self-harm, like cutting, and not... like regularly, but just when my emotions got so big that I couldn't contain them anymore, to the point of like volatile explosion, rather than inflicting that on anybody else, I inflicted it on myself. And so this manifested in maybe three major episodes of self-harm, but the last one resulted in a hospitalization to get 8 stitches in my forearm. And the thing that I felt most ashamed about that was that I actually had to get my grandma to take me to the hospital, and that kind of broke my heart. So I realized that this was not an appropriate way for me to be dealing with my feelings. But rather than actually address the problems that I was having, that behavior just kind of transferred to binge drinking. And then that behavior evolved into drug abuse. And this was, you know, between 14 and 18, through my teenage years.
I mean, of course, there's the obvious, but why were you so emotional about including your grandmother into that?
To put my grandma through that, like, I don't think she really knew the severity of what was going on, but then to have to get my grandma to take me to the hospital and for her to sit there the whole time watching me get stitched up and
worrying.
Worrying, and it kind of broke her heart. And I guess it probably, yeah, just to put her through that when I had never intended for my behavior to impact on anybody else. In fact, that's why I was actually acting it out on myself, so that I didn't burden anybody else with my problems. And this was like the most in-your-face burdening of somebody else that I could never have anticipated. And so, yeah, that's when it switched to drinking, because, again, like, I wasn't burdening anybody else with my self-destructive behaviour.
And then you look at the self-destructive behaviour, which manifested then into different things, because, you know, the methamphetamines became a different challenge for you, but still obviously self-harm.
Mm.
How long would you classify yourself as being addicted to crystal meth, though?
I started using crystal meth around the time that I retired from diving at 18, and I retired with no real intention of ever returning to the sport. So I was just partying and partying and partying at 18, and I did that for a year until I decided to start to change cities and start diving again. And that was 15 months before Beijing. And so, like, when I did moved to Sydney and start diving again, I went cold turkey off everything, but I knew that I was already having a problem. I went to see a doctor about it, and I don't know, he basically just said, there's nothing we can really do. There's no medical intervention. You just have to kind of stop.
And you couldn't stop?
Well,
you had no control.
I had more control then. It hadn't gotten out of hand yet when I was... Oh, yeah, it had started getting a little bit out of hand when I was 18. But when I moved to Sydney, I found it much easier to stop and to do nothing because I had diving to, like, throw all of my energy and attention into, and I was finding that that situation was very validating for me. I felt very accepted, and I had a goal. Like, it was probably, possibly, the fact that I had a goal, a really powerful goal. Like, I just wanted to make the Olympics because I'd never made the Olympics yet. So I went completely cold turkey of everything, no drugs, didn't drink, didn't even eat junk food because I didn't want anything to jeopardize my chance of making it to Beijing. But it took me about 6 months for me to stop thinking about Crystal every day. So,
wow.
Yeah.
You know, and that's such a big part of your life to think that every day that's what you think of.
Yeah. And I, you know, there were things that were triggering me left, right and center. Like, I had to stop listening to dance music altogether because it was far too triggering, which was nice because then I, you know, I got to explore lots of different kinds of, you know, indie and roots and world kind of music. So, you know, I really expanded my musical repertoire, which was nice. But, you know, catching public transport, like trains, there's a train station. In order to get to Olympic Park, you have to go through a train station called Lidcombe, and there's some graffiti there at the Olympic sprint platform that says Ice Age, the crackdown, and it's got a crystal meth pipe and a needle there. And so it's obviously got its drug references. And so every time I got on the train to go to training, so every day I was going past that graffiti. So, you know, it was... The triggers were sort of unavoidable, but like I did, like I stayed completely clean and sober all throughout that period, right until after Beijing.
What you've been through and to show that you can come out of it is a real sign of strength, but it's also a sign of hope for people out there that might struggle with the same thing.
Absolutely. But I did that sort of by myself, but only because I had such a strong, powerful goal, and I had something to direct all of that sort of compulsive and obsessive behavior into, which was the diving. But I still hadn't addressed any of the underlying causes of my depression. And so what I learned was a couple of years later was that unless you actually address those underlying causes, your depression doesn't really go away. It just kind of lays dormant, waiting for another opportunity to present itself. And it did. And I went into another period of depression around 2010. And obviously I just went back to the last crutch that I'd used to change the way I felt as a teenager. And that was, you know, the crystal meth. And so, you know, I'd feel like shit. So I'd use then and feel temporarily better, and then I'd come down and feel worse, and so I'd use again and repeated that cycle and perpetuated that cycle and just made it worse and worse. You know, like it was at its worst in an injury break. I had to take 3 months off to let some stress fractures in my back heal. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm just kind of numbing out to pass the time until I can start training again, but then it came time to start training again, and like I would promise myself with every single cell in my body that I was not going to use again, and I couldn't keep that promise. And every time I couldn't keep that promise, it tore my self-esteem in half again and again. And yeah, that's when I realized that I couldn't do it by myself and that I needed help. So, I mean, basically the point is, yes, you might be able to do it by yourself, and some people can, and that's great, but that doesn't mean, like, if you can't do it by yourself, that doesn't mean that there's no hope, because that's when you get help. You know, there are rehabs or programs, or, you know, there are fellowships, you know, 12-step fellowships that, you know, where the meetings are really great. It's great to be able to identify with people who've been through the same thing, who, you know, give you lots of experience and strength and hope that recovery is possible.
When you were out in public, do people see you in a drunk or drug state and be like, oh, you're Matthew Mitchum? So were they surprised to see you, or did you do this? Or was it more private than that?
You know, when I was using addictively, that was always in private because of the absolute shame around my addiction. I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing because not only was I ashamed of the depression that I was trying to medicate, but I was also, I mean, drugs in sport is a massive, massive taboo. Crystal meth has a particularly powerful, you know, stigma attached to it. So I didn't want anybody to know. So that was as secretive as I could possibly make it. And You know, like I never used in competition. I would always like detox before competition so that, you know, so that I could never be accused of being a drug cheat. And, you know, if I ever did get drug tested, it would never come up. So that was, you know, obviously another way of like never being found out. I mean, I'm sure like I used to party when I was younger, and I didn't really party that much after Beijing because people did recognize me. So I don't really know if anybody did.
No one ever said that to you.
Certainly nobody ever said anything to me.
I think it's all a part of your story, and it's sort of the thing I like about you the most is that it's accessible to people, for people to listen to this story for you. Yes, you might be an Olympic athlete. Yes, you might have a profile, but there's a lot of people out there that go through the same thing.
Yeah, and I guess it goes back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier around like being open and being honest. You know, from when I made that decision when I was 18, when I moved to Sydney and started diving again and made that conscious decision to be 100% open and honest with people, I really adopted that as a life philosophy, not just with my interpersonal interactions with people, because I was sick of, you know, like trying to, you know, perform, like express myself more masculinely or less camply.
Camply,
I've just made that word up.
It's funny that you say that, though, because like I don't even think of you being that camp.
Yeah, I am. I am. I have my moments.
I guess we're talking about really serious things, so it's like you can't really, you know, you're going to be flaying your camp arm around while you're talking about
exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. Oh my God, I'm depressed.
But look, I know that this sounds strange, but like while we talk about it in a way, it's lovely to be able to hear you laugh and be open and honest. I think that that's great.
Yeah. Depression isn't rainbows and unicorns, but it doesn't mean that you can't joke about it, because I mean that also makes it more palatable for listeners to listen to. Like, so if you tell a couple of jokes, self-effacing jokes, yep, then that's okay. That's why, you know, when the journalist came out to the pool, she said, who I live with, I said, my boyfriend. And, you know, and she actually gave me the choice of whether or not I wanted this to go to print, because she knew the stigma that the gays don't get the big endorsement deals and nobody had ever come out before. And, you know, this was actually a massive, massive deal. You know, she asked if I wanted this to go to press, and I took a night and ended up deciding that, yes, like I did want it to go in the paper, because I wanted Australia to know exactly who they were supporting should they choose to support me. That was the best choice I've ever made, because the media and the public have just been so incredibly supportive. And so it was a very, very positive, rewarding experience for me. And that then informed my decision to be as open and candid as I was when I released the autobiography in 2012 to talk about all the drug stuff, because I was already a year in recovery. So I didn't feel like this would impact my recovery in a negative way. I didn't feel like this would jeopardize my recovery to talk about it. But it was still a massive decision because I was still competing, and drugs are so taboo in sport. But again, the feedback that I got from the public was really, really supportive. So I've always had this philosophy that, I mean, especially since, you know, these last couple of experiences, these big experiences, that, you know, if the potential benefit to others outweighs the potential detriment to myself, then I really ought to share. And so that's why I do believe in being very honest and open.
You know, you've obviously been through so much with your childhood, and there's so many interesting stories that come from that. Don't you think in a way that that kind of shaped you to being more accessible? Because like when I say accessible is that, you know, they could have picked that other guy to do all these stories on, but they picked Matthew Mitchum to do these stories on. And I think that comes down to the fact that when you meet you, I think it's to do with maybe your eyes or whatever it is, but you get a sense that you're living your life. And I think that's helped you prepare you for this prolific role that you've become.
It certainly makes for good stories, doesn't it? Like that's what we like to see in the media, is we like to listen to good stories. I mean, who wants to listen to somebody who was born with a silver spoon in their mouths and, you know, their trajectory from A to B was a straight line that was only this long? No, we want to hear about somebody who's gone so far off the rails, which makes for a good story, and then they've gone through all of this effort to make their way back onto the straight and narrow. And then so their A to B is not just this short straight line, but this long wavy line that, when you straighten it out, is actually three times the length. They've lived three times as much life as somebody who's kind of had it easy.
and just so powerful. Now, when you were going into the Olympics in 2008, did you feel that you were going to do well?
Yeah, it's all in the preparation, really. And I had won the last major tournament in the lead up to Beijing. And my progress, like I had in the sort of in the five international events leading up to Beijing, I'd just gotten better and better and better and better. And so, yeah, my training was going really well. So I thought that I had a good chance of doing well. And then we got to Beijing and I came second in the prelim to one Chinese diver, and then I came second in the semi-final after the other Chinese diver. And so I thought, being, you know, the super optimist that I was, that's a lie. I was trying to be realistic, but I'm like, okay, well, both the Chinese divers have beaten me, so maybe the best that I could hope for is a bronze medal, and that would be amazing.
What did it feel like to win gold?
Amazing. At first, it was like just... I mean, I was crying for the silver medal that I thought I had because that was better than my wildest dreams. Because I thought, yeah, I thought having had a year off and being very self-destructive in that year and then only having 15 months in the lead-up to Beijing, it was not really ideal timing for me to do very well in Beijing. And I thought, well, you know, I just want to make the Olympics and then I'll make my big gold medal winning performance in London. So the fact that, you know, I thought I had won a silver medal in Beijing, I was ugly crying, like snot in mouth crying. Like it was just, I was full on. And then the last Chinese diver did his dive and completely fluffed it. And it was like the whole diving community just engulfed me right there on the pool deck. It was incredible.
From experiencing highs like that, is there a come down from that?
Absolutely. Why they call it a come down. It's because
what was
it's,
your journey though with that come down?
I mean, I guess it was like when I stepped onto the podium, it was relief. All of the stuff that I'd been through had been worth it, so yeah. There was that relief. And yeah, I guess it sort of took a little while for the reality of the magnitude of what I'd done to sink in. But then for some reason, I decided to check the world rankings when I got home from Beijing, and I saw that I was actually ranked number 2 in the world because a Chinese diver had won more events earlier in the year and had accrued more points than I had. And so I was ranked number 2 in the world. And so that childhood thought when I was 8 years old, I just want to be the best in the world. That hit me like a ton of bricks. And I was like, oh my God, I'm still not the best in the world. And so...
Oh, come on. You broke a pretty big record, though.
Yeah, I was Olympic champ. But, you know, like...
Tell us what it is.
I'm still the highest scoring dive in Olympic history.
There we have it. Yeah. And, like, to me...
I'm twirling my hair like a gay boy.
No, but you know what? For me, I'm such an emotional person. We've talked a lot about different things today. But when you say that, and when you say how amazing that is, that gives... I feel overwhelmed with emotion for you. Mm. Because it is something that you've set big goals for yourself, Matt, you know, in your life. Mm. I think you really have, and you've also achieved them.
Mm.
And I think that to me is something that resonates with me because I want to be good at something.
Mm.
And I think for you, you won gold and then going off to the Commonwealth Games and then winning gold again, what was it, 5 years later?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a bit of a, I can do this?
Like, it was the first time that I didn't consider my win in Beijing a fluke.
But that's what I mean. Like, looking at the next 6 years that happened for you, you really did prove something to yourself.
Yeah, I learned a lot and I grew emotionally because, you know, that, yeah, the win in Beijing was, it was the result of quite a negative emotional driving force. It was the result of a quest for validation, basically. Mm. And it was an empty victory, like, because it didn't give me that validation that I had always hoped that it would. And so when I got to London after having done all this work on my on reframing and self-esteem, and, you know, like, I didn't make the finals in London. I missed out by one place. But when I went back to watch the finals, I was so proud of these boys who were diving in the finals, who were doing what I was doing 4 years earlier. And that pride I was actually able to transfer to myself. And that's when I finally understood and recognized and appreciated the achievement you know, that I'd actually done it and that it wasn't a fluke and that I deserved it. And so that was, you know, there was a mental and an emotional win for me in London that meant more to me than that win in Beijing, in a way, because I was actually able to appreciate that win in Beijing. Mm. So now, yeah, I do have goals. I probably approach them in a much more healthy way. You know, like, my self-esteem is not dependent on the outcome of my goals. Mm. You know, I'm not using my pathological quest for validation to drive, you know, like, I'm still trying to become Oprah. That hasn't happened yet. You know, I'm still trying to, like, you know, dominate the Australian, you know, TV and radio waves. It hasn't quite happened yet, but I'm still working slowly on it.
Your determination for that has been different, you know, like, the determination to become a sports person and a determination to build a profile are very different things, because to build a profile and to be Oprah, it's a lot more to do with luck, chance and circumstance than people realise. You know, I mean, people, I could listen to you talk all day. So I'm like, give this man, you know, a radio show if that's what he wants, or give him a television program if that's what you want.
Yep.
But at the same time, those achievements aren't matched by a talent of working out, you know? I don't think so anyway.
But it's also, I recognise that those things have a lot, many more external factors as well. Like, there are other people, you know, people in power who have their own opinions and agendas and which I can't control. And so, you know, I understand that, you know, I mean, sport was great because if I had a goal, I realised that, you know, I could do anything that I wanted, or that it was within my power to do anything to achieve my goal, because I could work and work and work and work. And and that's something that I've had to let go of in other areas of my life, or I would become a nervous wreck and really, like, defeatist, because I can't control how other people think. I can't control whether there are jobs open or not. I can't control where, like, how many other people are also, you know, fighting for the same roles that I'm going for. I can't control, you know, how much money it takes to put together a project, to, you know, to do all the stuff. Like, there are all of these external factors that I can't control. And so all I can do is make sure that I put in a little bit, like, you know, consistent effort on a regular basis, and let go of the outcome, and hope that you know, little bits of regular consistent effort will accumulate and result in something eventually. But as long as I focus just on the process and what I can do today, rather than focusing on the outcome and why I don't have this yet, it keeps me much happier. It keeps me in the present, and it keeps me working.
Talking more about the LGBTI landscape at the moment, where do you think we've been? Like, where do you feel like we've been on that journey?
I mean, the reason why I did so much, like, as much as I did for, you know, to campaign for marriage equality, was because I wanted it. Like, even though I've been with my partner for 11 years, I mean, marriage isn't going to change our relationship. So it wasn't really for me. I wanted marriage equality for our queer elders who fought so many years and went through all of the horrific stuff that they went through, you know, went through criminalization and gay bashings and murders and protests and arrests and all of that horrific stuff, for us to enjoy the rights that we do have today. I wanted marriage equality for them. I also wanted marriage equality for, you know, our little queers with training wheels, you know, our queers to be, so that they don't have to grow up in the world that we did, where you know, we still, you know, grew up in a society that tells us that gay is not as good as straight. And I'm hoping that marriage equality will normalize all of that, so that won't be an issue anymore. Where, you know, because LGBT depression and suicide rates are astronomical compared to their, you know, heterosexual teenage.
Oh, absolutely.
Equivalents.
And I think that is the journey, is like being able to change a lot of that. And I think fighting for this plebiscite, but fighting for marriage equality, was about equality for all.
Absolutely. It was all about equality. It wasn't about marriage. Well, marriage is a nice sort of byproduct of it, but it was absolutely about equality. And, you know, and that's why I try and use the word equality. Like when talking about this whole marriage thing, you know, I try to use the term marriage equality more than same-sex marriage because it was about equality.
Where do you think we are now that plebiscites happened? You know, do you think there's a bit of a come down in a way?
I think there's going to be some residual resentment, I guess, from people within the community for having to go through that stuff. And that's what we saw with the whole eat shit Lyle trend on Twitter, which I actually am not, I don't support that at all. Like that's being a sore loser. Like I understand how damaging this was and that, you know, we should not have had to go through this, but the reality was that we did. And I understand that it caused a lot of people a great deal of harm, but it only serves to confirm what people who are against same-sex marriage, it only goes to confirm their fears and position on why they don't think that there should be equality. Because, you know, if people who, you know, are saying, you know, it's about love, are then turning around and going, you know, eat shit.
That's wrong. Yeah.
It's not, that's not about love, you know, so.
Well, I think that's why I think at the moment we just need to sort of pick up our bat and ball like the end of a game and be very humble.
Absolutely. And I'm sure there were people who, you know, who said this, and I certainly said it on my social media. Then again, I've only got, you know, I haven't got that many followers, but I certainly said it on my social media, we should be humble because we ultimately got the result that we felt is right. The process wasn't ideal, but we should be humble.
Interesting.
No matter what. Well, actually, in fact, before the result even came through, I said we should be humble no matter what the result, like no matter whether it worked in your favor or against. And so I was addressing people on both sides of the debate. I said we should be respectful of the outcome and be humble about it.
I was surprised that it actually had such a high number of yes. Were you surprised by the percentage of yes?
I literally did not let myself have any expectations because it's just something that I have to do for my own emotional health, is just to keep it in the present and to accept whatever the outcome was going to be. So if the outcome had have been no, you know, you just take it when it comes and you deal with that situation as it comes. Because, I mean, I didn't want to spend so much time, waste so much time and emotional energy thinking about an outcome that isn't here yet.
Is that about the protection of Matthew, though? Are you protecting yourself?
Yeah, emotionally. Mm. Because, I mean, by thinking about the future, it tends to give me anxiety because there's so many possible permutations of the future. And it's like, well, you know, coming up with a strategy plan for like every possible outcome is just, it makes me very anxious. Mm. So by keeping things in the present and just dealing with things as they happen is, you know, is sort of one way that I've learnt to sort of manage my own anxiety. And, you know, it's not like totally feasible. You do have to prepare for certain outcomes, but this was one thing that I felt like I had no control over. The only control I had over it was to put in my vote and to be as positive an ambassador as possible.
And where do you see this in the future? Like, looking forward into the future now, like, what has this outcome and this achievement meant for, as you said, queer people with their training wheels on?
I'm hoping that this does a lot to normalise it so that it's not seen as such a divergent sort of thing. And I'm hoping that it will make adoption laws much more easy for people. I'm hoping it will also make passing trans laws much more easy because there are still long ways to go with some of the trans laws at the moment. So I'm just hoping that, I mean, I feel like this plebiscite thing has been very uniting for the community, and I hope that the people don't just then rest on their laurels because, you know, like this one big major thing that we've been fighting for such a long time has happened, because there are still things to go. You know, there's
still homophobia out there.
And transphobia and biphobia. I mean, bi erasure and lesbian visibility in the media are two things that I would like to investigate further, like linguistically, obviously. There were no mentions of bi or or lesbian people individually in the whole corpus of articles that I looked at in 2016 in my one paper. And it's like
crazy,
because any time a lesbian was mentioned, it was like in context with like gay and lesbian, or like gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, or gay and lesbian people. Or
you felt like it was not being discussed fairly.
That there was, yeah, or that people, the media talks about women and, you know, like the but not like if a woman's a lesbian, it doesn't seem to be as overtly stated or reported about in the media. Neither does bisexuality. It doesn't get reported. So, like, this paper that I was looking at, it's actually trans people were... there were lots of trans issues in 2016 around safe schools, and Catherine McGregor was mentioned a lot, and Caitlyn Jenner was mentioned a lot. So, you know, trans visibility was quite good in 2016, but, you know, no, bi invisibility, completely invisible.
And it does need to sort of, I think that does need to sort of be looked at. And that's probably where we're going in the future, is redefining some of that and making sure that there is equality across all the LGBTI landscape.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess some people's arguments would be like, oh, it shouldn't matter at all. You know, like some people go, well, why does the media have to mention that he's the gay diver or the gay Olympic gold medalist? Like, he's just an Olympic gold medalist. And that's true. But I'm also very proud of my sexuality, and I'm very proud of that to be part of my title and my identity, especially while, you know, like there are younger people who, you know, growing up in this world where there are so few role models, I guess, particularly, you know, gay role models in sport. I had no gay role models in sport because...
Well, there weren't any back then.
There weren't any in the 90s, no. And so that's why I'm very happy for gay to be part of my title, you know, because I'm hoping to be a role model for younger people in sport.
Not to single someone out like Thorpey, though, but, like, you know, there's sometimes people who are in not just sport have media personalities who are aware of their sexuality but then hold it back for so long. Do you think that now that that's less likely to happen, that's setting a better role model for younger people?
I'm hoping so. Thorpey was put in a terrible position by being asked about his sexuality or about girlfriends, you know, as a minor, you know, because he was in the spotlight from such a young age. He should never have been asked about any of that stuff. And so, you know, he, to protect himself, I guess, because, you know, you're not going to say that you are something when you're not entirely comfortable with it yet, because that, you just don't. And so that, and he said this, that one act of concealment dug a hole for him that lasted over 10 years, which is terrible because, you know, like, first of all, as the media, it's completely unethical, even not just in the media, but it's completely unethical to sexualize a minor. Like, you should never have been asked about girlfriends or any of that until at least the age of 18. And he might have been a lot more comfortable at the age of 18 to talk about himself.
Lived a different life.
It could have made all the world of difference. That not being able to be authentic had ramifications on his mental health as well. So,
what about this, though? There was a real tipping point, I think, where we did change talking about equality rather than sexualizing ourselves. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that was a real game changer for us getting marriage equality across the line?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, a lot of Australians did realize, I guess a lot of Australians did kind of go, oh, okay, like, yeah, it makes sense for everybody to be equal. There were obviously opponents did focus on the sexuality aspect and the deviancy of it, and, or, you know, the trying to uphold the traditional notion of it. But I think most people saw it for what it is. You know, it was a request for equality, and most people feel that everybody should be equal.
Absolutely. Matthew, what's next for you? Like, as in, there's obviously lots of things that you want to achieve in your life. You're so young. So
I'm not so young anymore. Oh, yeah, I guess I am.
You are
compared
still
to a lot of people. Yeah.
What's next for you? What do you want to go? What are you putting yourself into now?
I don't know. I think I've been doing this uni degree like very, very slowly for the last 8 years, but I have a 10-year time limit on it, so I need to hot foot it and finish that up quick smart. I also, you know, I've been doing you know, my cabaret shows. I've got three shows now, Twists and Turns, which was the first one, Under the Covers, and Up Close and Personal. So, you know, hopefully I'll continue to tour those. I know that I'm going to continue to tour those throughout the next, you know, few years. I really want to work in media and entertainment. Like, I want your job, basically.
Maybe it's proving something to yourself.
Yeah.
So, maybe it's finishing, you know, you're wanting to finish something.
I feel like it's a plan D or a plan E, you know, like just in case, you know, diving doesn't make me rich, which it didn't. And, you know, cabaret doesn't make me rich, which I don't know if there are any rich cabaret artists, but, you know, like
Liza Minnelli.
But, you know, so there's a, you know, there's a, the responsibility of, you know, like balancing what I need to do and what I want to do.
Matthew, thank you so much for being able to join us today. Do you have a message to the community listening to this?
To the community? I guess through the plebiscite, we showed how much unity we have as a community. I think a lot of the pain and hurt and divisiveness of the plebiscite also did a lot to separate the whole community from the wider community. And I think we can, the way we carry ourselves shows what and who we are, and we all have the potential to be good role models in our lives. And, you know, being a good role model is not making mistakes. Being a good role model is, you know, if you do make a mistake, you accept that, you take responsibility from that, you apologize for it, you learn from that, and you use that experience to change your behavior and grow from it. And I think we as a community can grow and be really great ambassadors. Each one of us can be great ambassadors for our community.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.